session number 27075, reel 6.
Ordinary the legate, reel 6.
And so the action in the event of fire, the standard action, of course, is to shut off the engine and sideswip the aircraft in such a way that the flames are being carried away from the vulnerable area. Well, that was on the 5th of May. I did that flight with my instructor.
How do you restart the engine in flight?
Ah, now that's a good question I was coming to. Yes. We get all three bits of excitement in the one day. Action in the event of fire, abandoning an aircraft, and restarting the engine in flight. Well, we've done the action in the event of fire with our side-slipping bit. Abandoning the aircraft was quite simple. You can either jump over the side or invert the aircraft and pull out the pin of your straps and fall out. Jumping over the side can be hazardous in case we hit the tail. But that was unusual. Most people managed to miss the tail one way or another. Now, restarting the engine in flight, you get yourself to a safe height, like 5,000 feet, and you throttle back the engine. I'm just trying to remember whether we did it for real with the instructor. I'm not sure we did.
Did he just talk you through it?
I think so. Yes, I think so. I think that's what happened. And the drill is quite simple. You assume the engine's failed, so you pull the throttle completely closed, so it's just ticking over. There's no power coming from the engine. You then pull the nose up and let the speed drop right off, but before it goes into a stall or a spin, push the nose down so that the aircraft is diving almost vertically. Allow that for about 4 or 5 seconds and then pull back sharply on the stick, at the same time being careful not to stall the aircraft, a high speed stall as it's called, or go into a spin. And the action of pulling the airstream across the propeller is such that it flicks it. And make sure the ignition switches are on and the throttle is a little bit open. And with any luck, it'll restart. It's purely the action of the air on the propeller, just because that sufficient flick, because these little engines, they don't take much flicking. I mean, you can see people start them up with one hand quite easily, pulling on the propeller.
Sounds very much like that instruction on the 5th of May was almost pure instruction rather than actual example, because obviously you couldn't abandon an aircraft, could you?
That's right, yes. They just tell you how to do it. And as I say, I can't remember whether he did this restarting for real or just simulated. I think probably he simulated it. However, come the next flight on the same day, and I'm sent off solo to do side slipping and steep turns, and off I go, and I'm doing my side slipping jolly and all this steep turning, and suddenly another tiger moth appears on my tail. And I pull around, and having been learning steep turns, I pull around on another steep turn, and I can see it's an instructor with a pupil in the back. At least there are two people in it, so obviously one is an instructor and the other is a pupil. And this chap wants to dogfight. So we get into a dogfight, and good fun it is too, milling around. He's on my tail, I manage to get him off, you get on his, and he managed to go so on. And then comes a point where he pulls up into an almost vertical climb, and I try to follow him, And he sideslips away, dives away from me, and leaves me standing on my tail, whereupon the engine stops. And it did stop completely, the president. And that was that. So I got the thing in a vertical position, and it couldn't cope with that. So the propeller stopped going round, the engine stopped. But, armed with my knowledge from that morning, restarting the engine in flight, what do I have to do? Push the stick forward, get the aircraft standing on its nose, almost vertical, count four or five, pull back, make sure the ignition's on, a little bit of throttle, pull back hard on the stick, and there we are. Bingo.
How did you feel about that?
Car, relieved. But I wish I'd met, I didn't make a note of that. Actually, in those days, we didn't make notes on this side of the page. Later on, with all the operational stuff. So that was a bit of fun.
Did you practice forced landings at all?
Oh, yes, we've got one here, forced landing. Whether that was the first one I'd done, I think perhaps it could have been. These are all gliding approaches.
With the forced landing, are there different varieties of forced landing? I'm thinking, would you practice, obviously with the Tiger Moth it has wheels.
Yes.
Rather than a retractable undercarriage.
Yes.
But with a forced landing, is a forced landing landing on wheels, or is there another side to forced landing where maybe you'd practice how you would approach if you didn't have wheels, or your wheels were retracted or the aircraft was damaged?
The two distinctions you have are precautionary landing or forced landing. A precautionary landing is, let's say, you're lost. Haven't a clue where you are. Petrol's running short. Underneath is a nice big field, nothing on it. Let's go and land and sort things out. In which case, you very gingerly work your way around this field approach it just as if you were landing on your own airfield, but with a little bit of extra height, and just plop it down on the field and see if you can find a passing farmer or whoever to tell you where you are. And so yes, we did that, and we did actually land in a field. And I discovered afterwards they use the same field all the time.
So that's the precautionary
landing. That's the precautionary landing. A forced landing is when your engine has failed. If the engine was just on the blip, I think that would be more of a precautionary landing. But if it stopped altogether and you can't restart it, whatever you do, whatever type of aircraft you're in, pressing all sorts of buttons and trying to restart the engine, then you've got no option other than to force land in whatever you've got available. And if you're lucky, there's a nice big field there in which you could pop a Tiger Moth. But of course, time is moving on now, and the more high-performance airplanes that are coming along, it's got to be a jolly good field to give you enough room to land it with wheels down. So the tendency nearly always was to do a wheels-up landing. And in fact, I did one at operational training unit in a hurricane. The engine stopped. And I had got a reasonable field. It wasn't big. It certainly wasn't big enough to land wheels down. So I decided I'd have to land wheels up, which I did, and it merrily ploughed its way across the field, came to a standstill. In fact, the damage was quite small. Obviously, the propeller broke because it was a three-blader. If it had been a two-blader, it might have stopped that way. Being a three-blader, one of the blades was bound to go, which it did. The radiator, which is immediately under the pilot's seat, more or less, the radiator took the full shock of the landing. And fortunately, it did slide along straight and level. The nose would have been down a bit, but it slid along like that. But the wings didn't touch the ground at all. So it came to a standstill, the wings untouched, tail untouched, propellers busted. As far as one knew, the engine was all right, except the fact that it had stopped. But the radiator had taken the whole load of the landing, and it was concertinaed fairly well, about half its size, and full of mud. But otherwise, that was it. So forced landing, at that time, you could get away with, if you're lucky, without too much damage.
How did they show you that in the training, and obviously in the elementary training? What would they do? Would it again be another instructional thing? Because obviously you can't do a forced landing, but would they give you any preparation within that training?
Yeah, you just do an approach to a field with power on. You just let the power. The art of the whole thing, of course, is to bring the thing to a point where you can get over the hedge safely, and get it down on the ground without doing too much damage.
So it's almost your location, isn't it? From what you're saying, is to position yourself.
That's right. That's what they can teach you. They can show you how to manoeuvre the aircraft to get to a favourable position, so you can be sure of getting it down in one piece. Even though you might do some damage, at least you wouldn't wreck the thing by going through a house or whatever. So yes, they teach you that. And then you come on, of course, to aerobatics.
Well, what did that entail then?
Well, this would be the whole range of manoeuvres, from an ordinary simple loop, looping the loop, rolling off the top, pulling her up, top, rolling over, slow rolling, right the way over, up the other way, left or right.
Is that into an inverted position?
Yes, and right continue right the way around. A slow roll, you go right that far, and continue up the other side until you're back to where you were, straight and level. It's a slow roll. A barrel roll is very easy to do. You just push the stick over, and it sort of slurps out and then slurps up the other side. It's easy enough to go down that way. You've got to judge it right there to bring yourself back to where you started. Some people are very good at slow rolling. I was never very good at slow rolling. Some people actually used to do beautiful, smooth, slow rolls. You see them at air shows. So we'd do that. Inverted flying, which you couldn't do much of in a hurricane because the engine, the Merlin engine, would stop after a while. You've got this float chamber problem. The Germans didn't have it. They could fly upside down as long as they liked.
With the Tiger Moth, were you practicing?
No, it would cut out. But we do slow rolls. It's an art, really. Aerobatic flying, it's touch. Some people have got it, you know. Rather like motor racing, there's just that little bit of extra touch.
Is that, again, the feel of an aircraft, really? Or
is it the feeling the aeroplane, yeah.
Was that the last sort of thing that you did with the elementary flying school?
Aerobatics? I don't think we didn't officially do dogfight at elementary school.
Was that occasion when your engine cut out the only time that you unofficially did dogfighting?
The only time? Oh, no. No, I did quite a bit of dogfighting. On Tiger Moths. Oh, no, we didn't do all that much on Tiger Moths. Masters, we did quite a lot of dogfighting, yeah. But this was authorised. We were told to go out dogfight. Right, so then at the end of May 1940, I completed the elementary course at Perth, flying tiger moths, for a total of 51 hours, 35 minutes, of which half was dual instruction and half solo. At that time, we had not done any night flying, and so I went down to Yatesbury in Wiltshire on what was called a pre-fighter course, which was to include night flying. And indeed, I did my first night flight dual in a tiger moth on the 1st of June. I must say, the whole thing was quite mysterious. It was a very dark night, I recall. And there was very little lighting to be seen. The flare path was a string of little glim lamps, which weren't all that easy to see. The surrounding country was downland, which rose up to some height above Yatesbury Airfield. So one had to be pretty sure on what one was doing to avoid coming to grief. However, the instructors put us in the right direction, and the night flying started. Not that we did all that much of it, but at least it was an introduction. And at the same time, one had more freedom in the time one spent in the air solo. One could do pretty well a whole range of aerobatics if one wished. And also formation flying became a fairly important part of the course at this stage.
Could I ask about night flying? Is there any special technique to night flying?
I don't know there's a special technique. The procedures one follows will be exactly the same whether one's flying by day or by night. The only principal difference was that if one was going night flying, it was the rule that the aircraft you were going to fly had to be air tested in daylight during the afternoon before the night flying program commenced. And this was something that was a carryover from the early days when aircraft weren't all that reliable. And so it was deemed necessary to check out every aircraft when it was going to be used for night flying. But the procedures would have been very much the same. I think the principal difficulty pupils had on the first night flight is finding one's way around in the dark, i.e. starting up the aircraft and then taxiing it to the takeoff position with very little in the way of lighting, if any at all. Once one was in the air, there was very little to be seen on the ground on dark nights. There was virtually no horizon that was discernible, particularly if the weather was a bit hazy, as it often was. So one was thrown on to paying a lot more attention to one's instruments than had been the case when one was flying in daylight. At the same time, of course, one had to be very much aware of where one was, because in a tiger moth, one was going to have no help whatever from the ground, because one had no radio. It was dark. One might have a map stuck in one's boot, but to try and make any sense of it in the cockpit on a dark night when there's little to be seen on the ground didn't help very much. However, somehow, evidently, we got away with it. I was trying to remember and looking through the book to see whether we in fact did any cross-country flying, landing away at other airfields at night. I don't think we did, not at the elementary school. That was going to come later when we got to flying the advanced types. And this was going to happen from early June onwards, when I was posted up to Scotland again, to Montrose on the East Coast, to the Advanced Flying Training School at Montrose, which was number blah blah blah, number 8, I think. Yes, number 8, number 8 FTS, Montrose, where we were introduced to the master.
Could you tell me a little bit about the master?
Yes. It's a low-wing monoplane with a Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine, very reliable engine, used by practically all the Hawker-built aircraft, the Harts and the Hinds and the Fuhrers, all had Rolls-Royce Kestrel engines in, and so did the Master. Two-seater with the pupil's seat in the front, and the instructor sitting behind in a tandem position, in a seat that could be raised when the aircraft was coming into landing.
Right.
The object of which was to enable the instructor to see over the head of the pupil in front of him. Particularly important feature when the aircraft is coming into land. By this time, I had flown a total of 70 hours.
What? There we go.
And I was then allocated an instructor, and I was blessed with Flight Sergeant Midwinter, who was a splendid chap, one of the hardcore of the pre-war RAF non-commissioned officer pilot instructors, first class fellow. And although we were about to step into a very different aeroplane to the Tiger Moth, the Master, in fact, was not all that dissimilar from the Hurricanes and Spitfires we were going to fly later on. The principal difference being that it didn't have the big Merlin engine, and it was constructed principally of wood, plywood, and did contain all the elements of an operational aircraft. That is to say, the undercarriage would retract, the air screw had a variable pitch, it had a full instrument panel, and in many respects was not all that dissimilar from the more advanced types.
Could I ask about variable pitch and what that term really means?
Yes, it means that the blades, the propeller blades, the angle of the propeller blades can be varied so that it has more, the propeller has more or less bite on the air that it's pulling the aircraft through. For takeoff, when the aircraft is to be moved from stationary, the pitch can be set to fine pitch. Once you're airborne, you can then alter the pitch of the blades with the appropriate lever so that the engine speed is reduced, enabling the bigger angle on the propeller blade to take a bite into the air. Now the program to be followed at the advanced school in many respects is very similar to the one we've just been doing on Tiger Moths. Though of course the way the aircraft performed bore no comparison at all to the Tigers. The Master was a very good aeroplane. The unfortunate thing about it was that its wooden construction wasn't all that reliable. And there had been instances where pilots had been carrying out authorized aerobatics in the Master, and the tail came off. And indeed, there had been a number of fatalities. However, the unfortunate thing about this was that throughout the whole of the advanced flying course that I was now embarking on, aerobatics were not permitted, authorized or unauthorized, because of this ever-present danger that the stresses imposed on the tail section during aerobatic maneuvers were such that the tail could snap off, as indeed they had done, with dire results. So this was unfortunate for people who were destined to become fighter pilots, that throughout the whole of the advanced course, one is limited in the amount of the in the degree of maneuvering that one could carry out in the air. However, that apart, we got on with the course, did all the various exercises that were required, and by, let's have a look, yes, by the middle of June, we were beginning to stray away from our home airfield and carry out cross-country exercises to other airfields, mostly in northern Scotland.
Would you be given a specific airfield to fly to, or was it up to the decision yours and your instructors?
No, you'd be given a destination. Yes, yes, one would be told to carry out a triangular cross-country flight, shall we say, starting at Montrose, possibly going up to the north coast of Scotland, then back down across the mountains to possibly Perth, and then back home to Montrose on the east coast.
Would you do the navigation for those flights?
Yes, I see in my book here the first navigation exercise was dual with my instructor, Flight Sergeant Midwinter. Following day, or a couple of days afterwards, I did a cross-country exercise solo. In fact, I did two solo navigation flights that day, and another one the following day. So one was beginning now to take more interest in the world around one, rather than the almost exclusive attention one had been paying to one's own airfield.